I'm doing a podcast, Dizzy.
Hello and welcome to the Too Cool for School podcast. I am your host, Yannick, and on today's episode, we are speaking about alternative provisions and pupil referral units. So I have a special guest with me today. If you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Wumi, and I work as a multi-agency specialist task force manager in an alternative provision in Inner London.
So just got to crack in and get on with it. So how long have you been working at the alternative provision?
So I'm currently in my seventh year in this alternative provision. I started as a teaching assistant and then worked my way up to being a multi-agency specialist task force manager. And I'm also an associate senior leadership member at this AP. So it's quite an extensive, very full on, and a lot's happened for me career-wise in the last 7 years.
Yeah. And just for clarity, what's the difference between an alternative provision and a pupil referral unit?
So ultimately, pupil referral units and alternative provisions are near enough similar. They're the same thing. They provide pupils who can't access mainstream education with an opportunity to thrive in an alternative provision. But I think, what I know is pupil referral units get a bad rep. You know, there's often that stereotype and that stigma that pupil referral units are a breeding ground for, exploitation, criminality, CCE, CSE, that kind of thing. But ultimately, these pupils come from somewhere.
Yeah.
They don't just drop from the sky into pupil referral units. And also, I don't agree with pupil referral units being a thing. I think what we offer is alternative pathways for students to access their learning, their education, as well as holistic wraparound support that a mainstream school just can't provide because of, obviously, financial barriers maybe, and also staffing constraints. You know, in a mainstream school, you've got classes of 30, 31, and one teacher. When I was in school, probably when you were in school, you had a class teacher and a TA. Whereas now, they don't have that. Schools don't have capacity to fund that. Whereas in an alternative provision, we've got high staff to student ratio and lots of wraparound support for not only students, but also their families. So families get held in the same regard as pupils.
Could you provide some insight in terms of the sort of staffing role? So what types of staff do you have at an alternative provision?
So at my current alternative provision, we've got obviously teachers, teaching staff, we've got TAs. Mm-hmm. We've also got what we call therapeutic educational practitioners.
Okay.
And they are sort of a blend between teaching assistants and learning mentors. But what they do is, and their roles are quite pivotal to the running of the AP, because students form positive, safe and trusting relationships with these members of staff. And what they do is support students in overcoming barriers to education and learning. Yeah. We've also got a multidisciplinary team that comprises of an ed psych, embedded CAMS practitioner, SEN assistants, an interventions manager. We've got myself. I've got a youth worker, youth justice worker, family outreach worker, transition and progressions coach, social emotional mental health coach. And we've also got the safeguarding team, which comprises of safeguarding key workers as well as the safeguarding manager. And everyone's roles, we work together like cogs in a mechanism. You know, each child and their family will benefit from a level of involvement with whatever we've got going on, whether that's SEN support, whether that's safeguarding support, whether that's multi-agency support to overcome barriers to engagement. Because we can establish those positive relationships, it makes it easier for children and families to want to willingly engage as opposed to it being imposed on them, if that makes sense.
No, that does. Yeah, that's very insightful. Thank you. Does the resources that you have at your disposal within your provision allow you to offer the students like an enriching curriculum? Because I think one of the concerns that many parents had expressed, to me when I was still in education about alternative provisions and pupil referral units was the quality of work, the standard of work, the type of work. And, that sort of sense that if you go to an alternative provision or a pupil referral unit, it's essentially a youth club and there's no work. So does the provisions and the resources that you have there allow you to offer the students an enriching curriculum?
Absolutely. So we follow the standard curriculum anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And our teachers, I would say, are the finest in the game because they take a lot of time out to scaffold the work and structure it in a way that students can access it. So my provision, we are trauma-informed and also a nurturing school. And one of the six principles of nurture is children's learning is done developmentally as opposed to chronologically. So in a mainstream school, the work is geared towards your age. So if you're 13, the expectation is you're going to do maths work that a 13-year-old should be able to access.
Mm.
But actually, if a pupil comes to us, but their reading age is below average, how can we then expect them to access work of their chronological age? No. We break it down, we chunk it, we throw in interventions to allow them to catch up and work accordingly. That's how we measure our success and that's how we measure our progress. You know, pupils in a mainstream school, you know, you've probably got lessons that are about an hour long and it's probably English. But if they are chronologically aged 13, but they've got the reading age of a 7-year-old, how do you expect them to sit in that 1 hour lesson when they can't access it? And again, because of the constraints of teaching staff in a mainstream school, they might not be able to have the time or the resource to be able to break down and chunk the work accordingly for that specific child. Whereas in my AP that I work in, I told you my teachers, they're like gold dust.
Wow.
They do everything and anything they can to support students in being able to learn in a way that suits them and meets their needs. We compare it to like private education because we've got a maximum of 8 pupils per class and it's one teacher and you've often got a support member of staff or two in there. So each child is given that one-to-one support at one point in a 45-minute lesson. They're not going to get that in a mainstream school. And we get students that come to us for like respite placements. And once they come into the end of their respite placement, they're like, I don't want to go back to mainstream school.
Yeah.
Because the support and everything that's been provided to me here, I'm not going to get that in mainstream. And I'm worried that I'm going to revert back to my old behaviours.
Yeah.
But because we can often offer them like remote mentoring and like light check-ins to just make sure that they're staying on track, it helps with that reintegration. But we do what we do and obviously it serves a purpose. Yeah. And when you hear quotes like that from pupils, you know that we're doing the right thing for them.
And what are some of the reasons that students are referred to your provision from a mainstream school?
Majority of the time it's persistent disruptive behaviour. But obviously, as I've just explained, if they can't access the curriculum, then little things such as talking to their peers or messing around in class will often go on the books as persistent disruptive behaviour. Sometimes it might just be for one-off incidents, you know. If a kid's being picked on and the school's not doing what they need to by the kid, they'll take the law and matters into their own hands and maybe turn up at school with an offensive weapon.
Mm.
So that means that they're directed to us. But post-pandemic, I would say a majority of the referrals to us is for persistent disruptive behaviour. And then obviously by the time we unpick those layers, we realise that there's probably an underlying SEN need that's not been picked up right from primary school, or there's an element of trauma that this young person has gone through that has shaped them and has impacted the choices that they make and the behaviours that they exhibit. And that's when we come in and, you know, middle leaders, we meet around the table and we're like, okay, what can we offer this child to get them back on the straight and narrow? And it's not always about classroom. It's not always about being in the classroom. Sometimes it's about those enrichment offers. So music, PE, other sports, creative arts, even cooking.
Yeah.
It's little things like that that can make a child's educational experience a lot more better. And yeah, it's just what we tend to do is we tend to think outside of the box and just think, well, if we were this child in this situation, what would we want? That's how we look at all of our students, and it does help. Sometimes it doesn't, and that's okay because at the end of the day, we're just school.
Yeah.
And we've got other agencies and a partnership that we work in. But I'd say for a majority of the time, the work that we do is enough to make a tiny difference. And that's all that matters, really, at the end of the day. I've learned that I won't always see the seeds that I've planted in their life. But when they message me on my work phone years later and they're like, Miss, do you remember me? Or can I come in and let's have a catch up? And this is what's going on for me. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
So the things that I was saying and, you know, the work that we put in.
Those seeds that you...
Yeah, they've grown. They've grown. Yeah. And it's taken about 3 years, 4 years.
Yeah.
But that's okay because not everything is instant.
Yeah.
A lot of it is a slow burner.
Appreciating the journey. Exactly. Definitely. And, you know, you mentioned that word behavior. Behavior. And often alternative provisions and pupil referral units, when people think about those provisions, they just think of it as this is the place that you send kids who are badly behaved. But behavior essentially, you know, is a form of communication. These young people are telling us something. They're trying to communicate something with us that is not being, you know, addressed. So in essence, an alternative provision and a pupil referral unit, yes, it may be dealing with the symptoms of the behavior, but not necessarily the cause root, you know, the root cause, sorry. So when we're, you know, trying to sort of dig into the foundation of why is this young person behaving like this, unless we're really trying to, you know, dig deep and look at the core and look at the foundations, you know, we won't really get to the bottom of some of these behaviors. So as a result of that, or on the back of that, do you feel that sometimes mainstream schools look at alternative provisions and pupil referral units as an easy route? Okay, this child is badly behaved. I don't want to deal with them. They can go to the AP. They can go to the PRU.
That's quite a loaded question. But what I was going to say is that one of the six principles of nurture, again, is behavior is communication.
Mm.
And if you're not trauma-informed to a certain extent, you're not going to understand or you're not going to want to see what that means. So again, post-pandemic, we've seen a rise in the number of students coming to us with complex mental health challenges. And in itself, like the pandemic was a trauma for a lot of kids, you know, that transition that couldn't happen normally, especially for students going from year six to year seven. That's a trauma. They didn't get to have a graduation party. They didn't get to have a prom. They didn't get to close off primary school the way they would have seen maybe older siblings or peers in years above them go through. But again, because mainstream school is so behaviorist focused, any little thing is seen as a challenge to the behavior policy. But when we look at numbers of children being neurodivergent, for example, how is your behavior policy framed in a way to accommodate them?
Yeah.
You can't expect neurodivergent kids to like walk in a straight line the whole day around school in silence. That's unfair.
Mm-hmm.
Forget neurodivergent children aside, teenagers.
Yeah.
Young people that are growing up, you know, they're finding themselves, they're realizing who they are. You expect them to walk in corridors in a straight line at a certain angle for the best part of 6 hours in a day. Mm. You know, there's this slant model as well that mainstream schools have adopted. I don't know much about it, but I've heard about it. And it's, you know, silence at all times. You must raise your hands to show that you're listening eagerly in lessons. Well, how about I can listen, but I'm not eager to listen. So you're going to penalize me because I don't appear to be eager.
Mm.
But by your definition, that's a behavior point. Why?
Yeah.
But also, if I've had an argument with my mum before coming to school, I don't want to come and sit in double maths, respectfully.
Yeah.
If I've not had dinner the night before.
Context.
I don't want to come into school. I'd rather go around the streets and see what I can salvage before coming in. But as soon as I get in, I might be, 5 minutes late. Oh, you're late. You're shouting at me. Of course, I'm going to get triggered. Of course, it's going to turn into a showdown.
Yeah.
Have you thought to ask me what's going on? Mm. Good morning. Are you okay? Would you like something to eat? Would you like something to drink? And it's those tiny little things that make a massive impact.
Yeah.
It's those tiny things. Don't expect me to come and sit in double maths on a Monday morning. You don't know if I've had food to eat over the weekend. And I know that's not your job because it's school. But what happened to empathy? What happened to kindness? What happened to understanding? Not everything should be put down to simply being a behavior concern. Because
yeah.
The majority of the time, it's not. And by the time you unpick it, you'll realize that, oh my God, these kids have got so much that they're battling against. Yeah,
they're going through stuff.
They're really going through it. And you know what? Every day they come into school, you should actually celebrate that, because they could decide to turn left on their way to school and go about their business, hanging around on the streets, getting up to antisocial behaviour. But the mere fact that they've come in, then that means they've realised that school's a safe place.
Yeah, it's a protective factor.
Exactly, a massive protective factor. Yeah. But if you're constantly penalising them for things that they seemingly don't have control over, eventually it's no longer going to be a protective factor.
Yeah.
And that's when they fall into the wrong hands or into wrong company or the wrong crowd.
Yeah.
And then it becomes an even bigger battle to try and fight.
So when young people are referred from their schools to your alternative provisions, what's their attitude when they come into the alternative provisions? What's their attitude at the start of that journey?
Okay, so fortunately, I sit in on the admissions process alongside a couple of other colleagues. And for some pupils, they are absolutely petrified.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously they've heard about what APs are like or PRUs are like. And they expect to come in and see kids climbing out of gates, kids, you know, smashing windows out through punching them. But actually when they come in, it's still a learning environment. We're still a school.
Yeah.
We're just wired differently.
Yeah.
So when they come in, they're like, oh, it's really quiet. And I'm like, yeah, because it's school. The kids come here to learn. You might see the odd child wandering in the corridor, but they're just having a movement break because they can have a movement break when they come here.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to see how quickly the anxieties can sort of subsidize in the space of about 45 minutes. Because by the time you start talking to the child and the parent about what the PRU/AP can offer them, shoulders start to become a little bit more relaxed. Young people start to be more engaged in the dialogue and they start to be a little bit more open and reflective about what has brought them to this point. And then they start feeling optimistic about the fact that, you know what, I can return to mainstream school. This doesn't have to be the be all and the end all.
Yeah.
There are some other kids that come and they're just like, don't care. I'm just here because I've got to be here. Don't want my mum to get fined. And that is often a harder challenge, because you've got standoffish teenagers who don't want to be there, but they have to be there because their social workers probably forced them, or maybe their yacht workers forced them. And why I say it's a battle is because they are so completely disengaged that it almost feels like whatever we offer might not be enough.
Yeah.
But majority of the time, we do offer the right things because we are an alternative to what mainstream can offer. So if it's, you know, a more highly specialised nurture provision that you require, where you've got consistent adults in a special area of the school, cool, that's for you. If it's accessing your education split, so off-site some days and on-site some days, cool, so be it. And if we know that you'll be fine to manage being in the wider school, so be it. But I think it's very rewarding when, one, you finish meeting parents and the child and they leave with a smile.
Yeah.
Ready to come and try their first day, the following day. Yeah, that's rewarding. But also when the kid comes to the end of their journey, you know, parents come in or they send emails or text messages to express their gratitude.
That's amazing.
It does more for me than anyone can imagine, because we like to call ourselves a dysfunctionally functional family. So every child that comes through our gate, you know, when they leave us, we say, you remain part of our family.
Yeah.
So if there's anything that we can do to help or support you, and not just the children, it's the parents too. If there's anything we can do to support you or help you, pick up the phone. Because we acknowledge that you might find it hard to be able to advocate for yourself or for your child, but we can support you where we can.
Yeah.
Using the right language, the right terminology, signposting you to, you know, key agencies that can actually fight the good fight for you. Because,
yeah,
you know, sometimes we have got to be impartial, but that doesn't mean we can't signpost you to relevant bodies that can do the needful. But testimonials are always a good way of realising that what we do is not in vain.
Yeah.
And doing it's actually 100% doing great work. Yeah. And it's, again, it's a unified effort. It's everybody around the table coming together. And don't get me wrong, like, it is a highly stressful environment and sometimes it can get a bit much, but the beauty of it is when you hear the kids say, thank you for giving me this opportunity. Or if I was in mainstream, I probably would have been, they probably would have suspended me for doing this or that. But because we're quite restorative as well, we wanna get the kids to understand the why, like why they make certain decisions or why they respond a certain way.
Yeah.
So we unpick things, as painful as it is, we unpick things. And that's why I often give them that pre-warning ahead in the admissions meeting. And I say, look, we don't penalize kids unless you do something that is extreme.
Yeah, yeah.
But any other thing, we want to work with you so that you can understand why it is that you've made this decision or why it is that you've responded this way, so that we can then equip you with a skill set to be able to manage in the future moving forward, so that you don't keep making the same mistakes and so that you can realize that you are above making wrong choices.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if a school can't teach you how to right your wrongs, then who's going to teach you how to? Obviously, apart from your parents, but who else is going to do that? So we're more of like a supportive factor in the lives of these kids.
Yeah. That's amazing. And you've spoken a lot about parents and the importance of parents. And, you know, I found, you know, working as a head of year, the most successful students that I worked with, the parents were involved. Like family had to be involved. And, you know, that's the sort of free will cog of school, student, parent that really, you know, if you work as a cohesive unit, it just makes, you know, things work. But obviously that's in a mainstream school when sometimes, you know, even that was a struggle for some parents. But for the parents that, you know, did invest in their children, you know, it definitely paid off. What's your experience over the years of, you know, the parents that you've worked with, considering that you are an alternative provision? Have they been invested? Have they been supportive of the students?
It's a tricky one. I think sometimes they do start off resistant. Because some families and some parents are like, we don't need help. I don't know why my child is here. But then again, this is where being able to develop relationships, safe trust in relationships is a key factor. You know, staff in the school have got work mobiles. And, you know, we exchange numbers with not only students, but also their parents. And, you know, we just say, we like to keep in contact with you. And some parents from the jump, they're like, nope, not interested, because their own experiences have been, I only ever get negative phone calls. But we flip it over. We celebrate the little wins so that it complements when things go wrong. So for some pupils, you know, their parents will get a positive phone call and be like, this is groundbreaking, never received one of those. Or they might get a positive phone postcard in the post celebrating a piece of work that they've done. Parents are like, whoa, this is new. But we've realized that those are the keys to getting parents on board to support their child and also work alongside us. Because I think if you compound them with all the negativity in the world, they're going to switch off. They're going to disengage because no one wants to have to deal with that, especially if you've got parents that might have medical issues or high stress, high anxiety. No one wants to hear from a school that's constantly telling me my child has done this and my child has done that. But if you're calling me to say, oh, my child managed to sit a test, which they probably weren't able to do in mainstream, I want to know about it. Or they managed to, you know, receive a certificate for, I don't know, participation in a PE lesson where in mainstream school they were bunking. I want to hear about it. So obviously, if you're engaging in positive communication about their child with them, they're more likely to open up and want to share with you what's going on. But sometimes it can get a little bit tricky, because if a family's got like an allocated social worker or early help intervention worker, those relationships sometimes can be a bit fractured. So then they lean heavily on the school. But obviously, we're just school. We're not social workers. We don't have any statutory guidance on how to work with children and families apart from in an education manner and format. So what we do is it makes it easier to just signpost them and say, look, we recognize that you're struggling with XYZ. We think you might benefit from additional support. Do you mind if we make a referral to MASH? And obviously for some parents, it might be like, nope, 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 because they know what MASH is. But other parents, when you break it down to them and you say, look, social services isn't there to take your kids away from you. Actually, their job is to do the opposite. You know, we can support you in any which way that we can, but we just recognize that you might need more support, then they're more willing and they're more open to it. And we find that to be the case a lot more than years back. It's almost like that stigma of wanting to access additional support is almost dying down. I don't want to say it's definitely dying down, but we're working on it and we're constantly chipping away with the parents that we work with. It also helps that we have got a vast amount of support in-house. So because the support is in-house, they don't have to wait 3 months before they get seen, I don't know, by an EP or a CAM specialist, because we've got one embedded. You know, we've got youth worker who can look at extracurricular activities to support young people in engaging with things that interest them in their own time. We've also got like holiday offers that we get the kids involved in. And for a lot of parents, that's a big win because they don't have to pay. So imagine if you've got six kids and one school is offering you free holiday activities, you're going to push for your kid to join that. Because then it lightens the burden and then you only have to accommodate the remaining five. So it's these little things that we've realized make a massive difference for families and getting them on board to believe in the work that we do and the support that we provide.
Before I move on to my next question, I just want to, you know, share sort of my own experience of, you know, alternative provision and a pupil referral unit when I was younger. You know, I recall in secondary school and I, for the life of me, I can't remember what year I was in, but it was just before the Christmas holidays and I was sent to a pupil referral unit in East London. And I remember not going. I said, you know what, I'm not going to go because, you know, logistically, it just didn't sort of make sense of, you know, then the sort of mindset and the view that we had of, you know, pupil referral units. And I said to myself, you know, if I've got any issues there, you know, the pupil referral unit, you know, the date ends at 2 p.m. If there's any issues and people are waiting outside for me, my school ends at 3 p.m. So it's just, you know, those sort of things. And I said, it just wasn't safe, you know, for me to be there. And during that period, I don't recall school getting in touch to sort of see how I was doing. I don't recall school getting, not even just with myself, but even with, you know, my mum, but it was just sort of no check-in. And I thought to myself, wow, I've just been left, you know, I've just been left to my own devices. And I ended up going back in January because it was after Christmas. And there was literally no sort of return to school meeting. And again, this was maybe 20 years ago, and maybe things, you know, have changed since then, and the structures are a bit more rigid. But, you know, I was sent away, no return meeting, just went back. And I feel that creates a sense of neglect, which leads to my next question, that do you feel that when pupils go to PRUS and they go to alternative provisions, that it creates a sense of otherness, that it creates a sense of neglect, that people in mainstream schools or people in the community just see them as different and see them as outsiders?
I think it depends on their pathway to the AP/PRU. So I don't know how familiar you are with them, but we've got three different pathways. So you could either come as a respite placement, so your mainstream school still stay in touch. You could either come as a fair access, so you're from outside of the borough and you've just recently moved into the borough and the local authority needs to place you But also you could be a permanent exclusion, which means that your mainstream school has absolutely had it. So they're done. When you come as a respite placement, schools will do check-ins. So from what you've described, that was a respite placement. So actually what your school should have done is your school should have been at your admissions meeting to the AP. They should have scheduled regular check-ins. They should have had a review meeting. So the fact that you didn't attend the AP, that should have gone as an attendance issue for your mainstream school to pick up on.
Do you know what? Let me just clarify. I did. I went outside. I stood outside and I said, you know what? Yeah, this is long, man.
So you didn't meet anyone, like a member of staff in the building?
I was literally stood outside the building and I was just like, no.
It's not happening.
It's not happening. It wasn't. Yeah. Because you can't see in, like, the windows, like, you couldn't see inside. Like, yeah. I didn't know, you know, what students were there, what area they were from. And I just thought, it's not worth taking the risk.
No, I hear that. But like you said, a lot of things would have changed in terms of systems and processes. So now, if you're a respite placement, schools will be contacted to arrange an admissions day. If you're a Fair Access, then we'll get in touch with your parent carer, as well as the local authority, to get in touch with them to schedule a meeting for you to come in. And if you're permanent exclusion, then the local authority will communicate with parents to say your child has been directed to the local alternative provision in the area that you live in. You've been invited to attend a meeting, blah, 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 blah. And I would say, like, for the respite students, there's a limited chance that they would feel that sense of otherness. But maybe for the other two, so the Fair Access and the permanent exclusions, I can understand why they would feel that way, especially if they are stuck within the AP for an extended period of time. But nonetheless, like, they've got people in-house that are constantly advocating for them to sort of be taken to panel hearings and stuff, to be given a fresh opportunity and a chance to try in a different mainstream school. And it is challenging, don't get me wrong, but we're constantly, constantly, constantly advocating for these kids. You know, no child should be stuck in an AP forever. They should be able to come to us, receive all the support in the world, have all the interventions in the world, and then use this skill set in a mainstream environment. But obviously, if you've got significant SEN or SEMH challenges, then obviously we'd need to do the needful by you, such as EHCP applications, to find a specialist provision that can actually meet your needs. But again, that in itself is a whole long process and long road.
And I think that's one of the main issues with reintegration, is that they come to your provisions. It's a different structure. It's a different ratio. You know, you talk about the wraparound support. It's different, you know, resources and interventions and adaptations that maybe mainstream schools aren't able to provide. So when we think about reintegration, essentially, how successful would the reintegration be if we know that, you know, schools are stretched in terms of their resources, in terms of their staffing, in terms of what they're able to do, in terms of what they're willing to do as well in regards to their, you know, behavior and behavior policies. So how successful is reintegration, you know, really, if schools aren't able or sometimes aren't willing to replicate, you know, the things that were put in place, at the APs that, you know, would make the students successful. So, you know, reintegration is definitely, you know, a difficult aspect of it. So I wanted to also ask, what are the demographic of the young people, not only in your provision, but in the provisions in, you know, the area that you work? What's the general demographic of the young people in those provisions?
Majority male pupils, although we are seeing an increase in girls being referred to us. I would say there's almost an even split between Black, Caribbean, African, and also Asian. So Indian, Pakistani, Bengali. few white male kids.
Yeah.
Mixed, children of mixed heritage. It's almost like a mixed bag, but it's, I would say it's more of an, almost an even split between black boys and Asian boys.
Okay.
I couldn't give you the stats offhand.
Yeah, yeah, no.
But it's near enough that so on an everyday, I come in and I'm like, oh. Or like if I'm doing interviews at our other site and I come back to the main site the following day, I'm like, more kids? Like kids just come out from under tables, behind cupboards. And I'm like, who are you?
And I think, you know, that's an area not necessarily to be discussed today, but definitely to have as an area or a topic of discussion in terms of, you know, the demographic of, you know, the pupils that we see in alternative provisions and pupil referral units. Because from, you know, my experience, you know, as an educator, it is often, you know, black or brown, you know, students from ethnic minority backgrounds. But that's, you know, definitely a wider discussion perhaps for another time. You know, you mentioned earlier at the start of the interview, at the start of the conversation, sorry, that, you know, proves and AP sometimes get a bad rep. You know, people see them as, you know, areas that or an establishment, sorry, that breeds, you know, sort of youth violence, gangs, etc. Have you ever had to sort of deal with conflicts of students from like neighbouring boroughs, neighbouring areas? And if so, how have you sort of managed that?
So we have had to deal with such conflict, but I think because like multi-agency partnerships are quite good at communicating.
Mm-hmm.
If a young person is referred to us from somewhere and there are concerns that if they're in the same environment as other pupils from somewhere else, then what we do is we have professionals meetings and we look at risk assessments and we look at safeguarding, because before you can effectively educate a child, you need to ensure that they're safe. So if them being in our provision isn't the best thing for them, then we need to explore other options. And we'll often have that dialogue with the local authority to say, look, we're concerned about XYZ. What support can you provide us? And oftentimes, you know, by the time due diligence is done, sometimes these things can be resolved through a matter of, you know, repair and restore conversations with the pupils of concern. But oftentimes, if we are significantly concerned that street violence could spill into the school environment, then we make adequate adjustments and arrangements to split children of concern up. Can be hard, though, because if a child's been permanently excluded from school and there's only one place for them to go, your options are limited.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Your options are very, very limited. And again, there has to be like adequate evidence to suggest that this young person is at risk of.
Yeah.
And this is the language that they will use.
Yeah.
Risk of significant harm for, you know, adjustments to be made and alternatives to an AP being explored.
Yeah.
It is hard. But we try our best by all these kids, with the support of the partnership, and they all contribute to safety plans, risk assessments, because our priority is keeping children safe.
Yeah,
obviously.
And speaking of safety, whether it's yourself or your colleagues, have you ever feared for your own safety whilst working at the provision?
Personally, no.
Yeah.
A lot of these kids are just misunderstood and they tend to be judged by what people read of them. But again, like I've met kids who on paper are supposed to be like extreme deviants.
El Chapo. Yeah.
But if you meet them, the butter wouldn't melt.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And kids deserve to be respected and treated just like any other person, regardless of their shenanigans. And again, behavior is communication.
Yeah.
If what's written about them on paper is what's written about them on paper, why haven't you unpicked what's led them to get involved in these extracurricular activities?
Yeah.
Why hasn't support been provided to occupy their time so that they're not getting caught up in stuff? But honestly, like, these are the kids that people have got the most brutal things to say about. But when you see them in like a food tech lesson, they're having the time of their life.
Mm.
You see them at break and lunch, shooting hoops, shooting goals. They're having the time of their life. They come to school on time every day.
Yeah.
But you want me to believe that they are hardback criminals? Nah. They're just kids who deserve a chance to be children. We don't know what they've got going on for them at the time of what we're reading about them on paper until we meet them and we start to unpick, you know, what's going on with you? Is this true about you? Like, rah, talk to me. Wagwan, what's going on?
Yeah.
Talk to me on a level. I'm here to help.
Yeah.
And then they open up and you're like, oh, times are hard.
Yeah.
No wonder you're getting involved in all sorts of rubbish. Okay, cool. We've got, you know, maybe a little bit of funding here that can buy you a little, I don't know, pair of trousers for school. Because for some of them, it's that little, what, you need food vouchers for your mum to do. All right, cool. We've got you.
Yeah.
Little things. We want you to come to school and be a child because that's your job.
Yeah.
Your job isn't to provide for your family through any which way possible. Just come to school, be a child, be you. Let's know you for you.
Yeah.
Let's unpick what makes you tick. Let's unpick what your interests, your hobbies are and see what we can make of it.
Yeah.
So I just believe in treating kids as kids.
Yeah.
Level playing field, all of that.
That's amazing. And I think, you know, to follow up on that, in my time in education, and working with Prues, supporting Prues, or from my knowledge of Prues, I don't think or I don't recall ever hearing, you know, many success stories. And, you know, it's always the bad rep. It's always this person's here for doing X, Y, and Z. And essentially, whether it's an alternative provision, whether it's a pupil referral unit, it's a school. So I was hoping, if you had any success stories that you could share so that, you know, our audience and viewers, you know, parents, educators can, you know, hear about alternative provisions, hear about, you know, these type of establishments and know that actually there is good that is coming out of there.
So first, I think it depends on what everyone's definition of success is.
Mm.
And for me, success isn't linear and it's not the same for everybody. So in the last 3 to 4 years, we've had a fantastic transition and progressions team that work with post 16 pathways and transitions, and they've been able to secure post 16 pathways for the last 4 year 11 students that have left our AP.
Yeah.
So be it further education, be it employment, be it an apprenticeship, all those kids are going on to do something. And it's hard work, you know, because you're doing the applications for them, you're supporting them by going to interviews. So in the last academic year that we've just had, I worked heavily alongside the transitions team and I was really actively involved with year 11 support. And it just opened my eyes and I was like, these kids need someone who is literally going to say, meet me at this college for 4 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because your interview is on this day. Yeah. They need it. Should we be doing it? I don't know. But do you know what? I don't mind doing it because at least I can secure them a possibility for September. You know, we've got kids that have gone to college. It's not really tickled their fancy. All right. But they've gone on to secure full-time employment. Others have gone on to do apprenticeships. For me, a success story is when a kid can come back to the AP and be like, this is what I'm doing with my life. There was a kid that I worked with, like, in one of the first couple of years that I worked there. And she recently graduated. She's a dental nurse.
That's amazing.
Like, she messages me every other week and it's like, just checking on you with me. This is what's going on for me. And I'm like, you make me so proud. Because at the point that you get sent to a Pru, society's kind of like, done with you. You're like, you're next to bottom of the barrel. And again, because of stigmas and stereotypes, it lowers the self-esteem and self-confidence of a lot of children.
Yeah.
And you already know that children struggle with that.
Yeah.
So what they need is consistent adults that can reaffirm them. And it can be draining because you've got to tell them, like, you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Even when they're upsetting you by, you know, coming to school about an hour late into the day, even though you've called them to wake them up.
Mm-hmm.
But you still have to be on your A game and reaffirm them because you are that trusted adult in their life. Sometimes outside of their parents, but sometimes alongside their parents.
Yeah.
But success stories for me is kids coming into school every day.
That's amazing.
Kids having 100% attendance, maybe 99% punctuality. A win's a win. Kids getting certificates in rewards assembly, another success story. Do you know what I mean? It's children being able to engage with interventions. That's a success story. Because where we read about them, they're like, nope, refuse to engage. But they come to us and all of a sudden...
They're engaging.
You couldn't ask anything else from them.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So I think it's just about defining what your definition of success is for that child at that moment in time and working towards that. And then you pull out the next big goal. You've just got to be realistic with children and young people. Because unfortunately, they're living in the moment. They don't live for... As adults, we live for the future.
Yeah.
But they're not at that stage yet. So as the adults, we've sort of got to mold that in them and say, look, the choices you make today impact tomorrow. But a lot of kids take that literally.
Mm.
But we mean the tomorrow of the future.
Yeah.
So it's just about what your definition of success is and what your parameters are going to be to measure that.
And I wanted to know, what would you advise to mainstream teachers and mainstream schools in regards to how to manage, you know, challenging behavior? Because often, you know, they see challenging behavior, you know, they can't deal with it. It doesn't meet the, you know, the sort of requirements within their behavior policies. And you know, the next steps is to perhaps move them on to... Mm-hmm. to APs and PRUs. So what would your advice be to mainstream schools and mainstream teachers, or mainstream school teachers in terms of how to manage challenging behaviour?
That's a really hard question. That's a really hard question because I can only imagine how chaotic it is to work in a mainstream school. Mm. I think the only thing that I can advise is just talk to the child.
Yeah.
Just ask them, are you okay? Is there anything I can help with? Especially if it's a child who there haven't been concerns with their behavior, but maybe they've gone away for a holiday and come back and their attitude's changed, personality's changed. Just ask them, is everything okay? Like, is there someone that you need to talk to? I'm concerned about the change.
Yeah.
Just talk to children. One thing I know about children is they want to be spoken with. They don't want to be spoken to or spoken at.
Mm.
I was once a child, don't talk at me, talk with me.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, ask me, how am I? Like, don't just assume, and also don't just punish because you don't know what's going on. A simple, are you okay, could unlock Pandora's box for you. Yeah. And then obviously as the teacher, you then know where to go with the content of that dialogue. But just talk with them, you know, like, again, empathy, kindness, understanding, like those are the makings of what I believe is an educator.
Yeah.
If you don't have patience, you're in the wrong field.
Yeah.
You are 100, because kids are going to make mistakes every single day. That's their job. But we are their allocated guardians to support them. They're not going to get everything right 100% of the time. No, they're not, because they're still learning. But if you constantly penalize them every time they slip and fall, of course they're just going to be angry and aggressive with you and not turn up to your lessons. Just talk to them. Is everything okay? Literally. How are you?
Yeah.
Just to check in. Offer them that space where they can be themselves. Like a safe space. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a lot of pressure, but I think form tutors just need a little bit more time and support to be pastoral in a sense. You know, gone are the days where you would have had registration for like, I don't know, 30 minutes in the morning. They've probably stripped it back to like 10. And if you're a chronic latecomer to school, you're not going to see your form tutor.
Yeah, you're not getting none of that.
You're not getting that quality time with someone who is supposed to be your key person, your go-to.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's just being honest with them and being like, come on, what's going on? Talk to me.
No, that's very helpful. And to finish off, if you could speak to government now, we've got a new government in place. If you could speak to them now and ask them to prioritise one thing that would help support alternative provisions and pupil referral units, you know, to deliver the best educational outcomes for their students, what would that one thing be?
One. I've got a wish list. I just think funding so that these resources can be maintained.
Yeah, sustainability.
100%. Because obviously the previous government, unfortunately, stripped back a lot of funding for education and schools. And that's where, like, we can probably see the stark comparisons between when we were at school and the children of nowadays.
Mm.
But I know funding is a big buzzword, but funding is what feeds into sustainability and improved outcomes for young people, children and young people. So that would be the main thing for me.
Okay, thank you very much, Wumi.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure. So that was the Too Cool for School podcast. If you like our content, please subscribe and follow us on our social media platforms.